Well, I don't know which direction you want to take this conversation we're having with Tom Kane. I guess you could join in at the intersection of The Accident Man, the novel, and the research into the Princess Diana, quote-unquote, assassination. You could also push the question into other ways about other famous incidents and other ways in which accidents have masked the true attempt to end the life of a famous person, or how it could have been done. Tom Kane has done the research on this, or should I say his alter ego, the real life independent investigator, coming up in just a second, which we'll tell you more about too. But you could go that way, or, and I'm kind of curious about this, is there anybody listening that has ever been involved in a situation where they either heard about people who created accidents for money, may have been involved in committing some sort of crime in this regard, or have traveled in circles where you could also be informative to this conversation about the international elite group of former special operatives, both for the military and for private security, who do these types of things. And what do you know of accident men and women out there on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Tom Kane is the accident man. Hang on, everybody. We'll get to your questions and comments quickly. But I did want to finish where you were going into that at the top of the hour. Please pick that up. And then also, before we forget, do you know about accident women? I mean, are there female assassins out there that that are either known or hinted to by some of your sources?
I mean, there are certainly female terrorists. I mean, one of the things that was kind of interesting over the past few years politically is that we had this bizarre double strand in kind of what you might call politically correct thought, which said that on the one hand, women should and could and indeed must go into the military, and the military must do everything to accommodate them. But on the other hand, only men were capable of evil and violence. Only one of these possibilities could be true. You can't have both. The fact of the matter is that certainly in terms of terrorist violence and of this kind of homicidal violence of a politically or commercially driven kind, women have been involved right back. If you go back as far as the first revolutionary socialist act in Russia in the late 19th century, women were involved there and were involved right the way through. Women, the Chechen rebels, we used women in the Moscow theater siege to bring down airplanes in central Moscow. The Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany used women for terrorist activities. So if they're being used for terrorist activities, and I know that the 14th Intelligence Detachment, with the DET I was talking about, which is this sort of semi-official black ops unit in the British government, they use women. MI6 use women. MI5 use women. CIA use women. Therefore, all the people, there are plenty of women who have the necessary training. And of course, women have a tremendous advantage, which is that because we are societally conditioned to think of women as being peaceful, non-violent, non-aggressive, non-threatening, you know, an attractive young woman will get attention of a certain kind, but it won't be seen as a threat. She won't be seen as a threat in a way that, say, a burly, tough-looking, shaven-headed, you know,
swarthy-looking
guy might.
Yeah.
So I would imagine. And there is actually a female character in the book who's not actually been trained as an assassin, although she does kill people, but has been trained by the KGB to do other things. But yes, I would be certain that insofar as there are people for hire, some of the people for hire definitely will be women.
Right. If it was an accident for hire, in the case of Princess Diana, who would be the usual, I mean, other than the characters in your book, I mean, who's the usual suspects for something like that to have been pulled off? If you had to define them on the basis of just your research, where would you tell police and investigators to look first?
Again, it's hard because to some extent this is an issue which is discussed by the book. But when I looked at it, I thought, well, it's funny because I was talking about this with my editor at one point, and she said to me, oh, that's not a very good reason for killing her. And I said, well, what was a good reason for killing somebody? What was the good reason? be? What was the good reason for killing John Lennon? I mean, you know, right. Often people are killed for very bad and stupid and pointless reasons. But if you look at why somebody, apart from, we've discussed the royal family, we've discussed the British government, the two things I concluded were, well, where was somebody who had a financial interest in getting rid of her? That would be the first thing, because money doesn't talk, it swears. And money is overwhelmingly, I think, in this kind of a deal, you know, a predominant reason. So for who could afford to put out a large investment and still turn a profit? That's point one. Point two, why would this person have a hostility towards Princess Diana? And three, was there anybody, if you think of a kind of Venn diagram where you have these intersecting ideas, is there anybody who, A, has a financial imperative, B, has a particular reason for getting rid of Diana, and C, has a proven indifference to the commission of violent acts and the killing of innocent individuals? And I think there clearly was a person or a group of people, a category of person, who did have precisely those motivations. They had actually been mentioned to my interest in the inquest. It's really tough for me now because I really would be giving away the ending of my book if I were to specify, but I would just leave listeners thinking about, if you know what Princess Diana did and you think about who might have had a reason to have been very angered by what she was doing because it was hitting their business, then I think, to me, if anybody were to take her out, that's who it would be.
Well, I'm torn because part of me wants me to twist your arm and make you tell me on the other.
It's a Christian saying, yeah, tell us who Hercule Poirot is going to give away at the end of the. But no,
And that's my other part of me is.
Right now, I want to buy the book and I would ruin the ending for them.
Well, and that's my other side, is that I'm right up to that part of the book, and I don't want to know yet. So I'll go with that part. And we'll get Daniel here, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM for Tom Kane, author of The Accident Man. Daniel?
Hello, Ian, Tom.
Hi, Daniel.
I have lived through a real-life conspiracy. May 1st, 98 in Great Falls, the DA made it out that I had bombs and guns, 17 aliases in 5 states. I was set up. It was a staged arrest for rape. I was given an escape charge on day number 174 in the Montana jail, the date my Floridian mother bailed me out. When they wouldn't take me to trial, they put me in the Montana State Hospital for 68 days. Then I got out. They dropped the charge with prejudice. It can't be brought up. The county attorney tried to recommit me. He failed. I came down to Florida, where my mother lives, and I went to the civil courthouse, downtown Clearwater, and I spoke to a bailiff about getting a reference to a civil rights lawyer to go up against Montana. Coincidentally, 7 hours later, he shows up, according to the police report. I was knocked out by the cop and gave the paperwork to the officer, and I'm alleged to have walked up to the future bronze medalist in arm wrestling at the Florida Police Olympics and said, police. When I asked that the bailiff be deposed, they put me in the Florida State Hospital. I spent 6 months and a day there. I was illegally drugged. And the case carried on and on and on.
How would this involve it in an assassin or somebody that's creating an accident?
Well, if you put someone in jail and for a certain crime, I had to deal with a lot of grief.
I bet you would.
I found out later that my public defender up in Montana had put forth the rumor that I had done a Michael Jackson instead of a Kobe.
Okay, but Daniel, I'd appreciate that, but I at the same time, I just have to say, I'd rather restrict. I mean, it sounds like you were a victim of some prosecutorial malfeasance or something, but that's not the same as being involved in or having some intersection with the underworld that creates accidents for money. So I'll leave that, if I can, hanging out there, Tom, and let's get to Christian, west of the Rockies in Livermore, California, on Coast to Coast AM. Christian?
Hey, this is a great show, Ian. Tom, I wanted to ask you, there was a lot of anti-monarchist feeling among the Blair administration, and it was even, I don't know if you saw the movie The Queen, was even alluded to that
Alistair Campbell?
Alistair Campbell had been just a notorious anti-monarchist, as
quite right,
as was Cherie Blair.
Yeah.
Now, as I guess the way you just spoke, I'm pretty sure that this is not part of your book, but I don't understand why you wouldn't think that it would have been possible for the New Labour Party to go in and see the death of Diana as a means by which to get rid of the monarchy. Which
I see where you're going, because I think that the in hindsight, that seems, knowing as we do how the thing played out, I can see exactly where you're coming from. But I don't think that anybody at all had any idea of the impact that her death would have politically, culturally, socially in Britain. The hysteria that gripped the country in the wake of Diana's death took everybody completely by surprise. I mean, it was just a phenomenon. The whole kind of, you know, the stiff upper lip, so-called, the British were supposed to show at times of trouble, just absolutely vanished. We became hysterical. The whole country was kind of fevered. And so I think that nobody could have predicted that. And so, therefore, I don't think that anybody could have set out. And in any case, if you wanted to use Diana against the royal family, then she's much more useful to you alive. Because had she stayed alive, she would have been a constant alternative to the royal family. And from the point of view of the anti-monarchists in the Blair regime, they could have used her all the time as a contrast to the royals. They could say, and let's suppose she did have a Muslim baby. They could say, here's Diana. She's so cool. She's so modern. She's multicultural. She's got a Muslim baby. And here are these fuddy-duddy old royals, and they're just hopeless, and they're just the past, and they're all about privilege, and they're all about, you know, things we don't want to have any part of anymore. So I think they would have an interest in keeping her alive, to be honest with you. And I hear what you're saying, but I think even if you take that quite cynical, and by the way, it is impossible to be too cynical about Alistair Campbell, because trust me, he will out-cynic you. So there's no motivation I would not believe about him. But I mean, I know Ali well. We used to work together. I mean, he and I are both journalists, and I've worked with him. And, you know, he was a very troubled soul, Alistair. But in any event, I think Diana was more used to them alive than dead, is my point.
Let's go first-time caller line. Peter is in Toronto on Coast to Coast AM for Tom Kane, author of The Accident Man, novelized version of research into the underworld of accident creators for money. Peter?
Hey, how's it going? What I was going to say was, before you're talking about female assassins and female, I guess, terrorists and stuff, well, one example, another one would be Joan of Arc is one you didn't mention. She was definitely a revolutionary and a warrior for many. That's one that I'd like to mention too. Another thing that's unrelating to the show, but also you guys should also check out. Do you have you mentioned Benjamin Fulford on the show before?
I don't think so, but I really can't hear you too well because of that radio on in the background. So that may have to wait for another time, and we'll stay on that topic then. Wildcard line, Charles is in Kentucky on Coast to Coast AM, and he's got a question for Tom Kane, the accident man. Charles?
Yes, hello, Ian and Tom.
Hi, Charles.
Yes, first of all, I'd like to make a quick comment that the day Princess Diana died, two other people died, Sister Mother Teresa, and not to compare her to them, but someone that I loved very dearly, my grandmother, and they all died on that same day. So I feel I always felt close to Princess Di also.
Right.
But I have two parts to my question. One is about Princess Di. I heard a theory that of a strobe light being flashed at her from the front. I think you may have covered some of this.
Yeah. Well,
we talked about it, but we didn't get back to it. We'll get back to that. What was your other part, too, and then we'll get the answer.
Okay. And you did mention the security footage. That was another part of that. My second part would be JFK Jr. is dying in the airplane.
That's great. Exactly, Charles. Two great questions.
It's funny you should mention that, Charles, because I was going to take that as a very interesting example. To the best of my knowledge, there has been no evidence of any foul play there. And there have been perfectly adequate explanations of why an inexperienced pilot, not properly qualified for instrument flying at night, could very easily over water lose any sense of horizon and simply plow the plane into the water. Aviation experts explain that perfectly credibly. But it is interesting. And if you think of his tragic family history, that would be a classic case if I were going to be thinking about, well, what could I take as an incident that I might fictionalize and build something out of and create a fictional hypothesis, certainly the material for that would be present in the death of JFK Jr. I mentioned Payne Stewart, but JFK was actually in my mind as I said it, and that is a classic case of where you have an accident, which may very well be just completely an accident, but who knows?
And about the flashing strobe light, because we intended to get back to that. Talk about the circumstances for that. And well, to this day, what do we really know about that strobe?
What we know is there have been two witnesses, at least two, I think altogether six, but two major witnesses, Levistre and Anderson, who reported immediately prior, who were in or around the tunnel at the time, and reported seeing a light immediately prior to the crash. And there's been a tremendous amount of poo-pooing, as we would say in England, of people dismissing this and saying no, it's simply a headlight coming the other way, flashing between the pillars would create this sense of flash in the corner of your eye. Although Anderson, actually, in his testimony, described it as being like a magnesium flare. And he would know because he spent a lot of time on the road with bands and knows all about pyrotechnics.
Right.
But what is certainly the case is, and then there's contradictory evidence about, well, if there were a laser, would you not be able to see it because it would be a very narrow beam? Or, in fact, would you actually see a much bigger green beam? And people have given all sorts of reasons why you could not see this laser. But what is the case is that these lasers do exist. They were developed as a means of non-fatal control of people because they can incapacitate somebody and they recover from it. And they have been used for riot control, and they certainly have been in the possession of special forces. I know, because I've spoken to people who've dealt with them, that British special forces, prior to the death of Princess Diana, did possess this equipment. Now, again, I come back to a bit like the Russians being able to take somebody out through a tire valve. You can take it as read that if one set of special forces has something, other ones do too, and people who are used to work for those special forces will be adept in the use of that technology.
And so, nothing precludes the possibility that two teams were working simultaneously without knowledge of the other one for the same event in the same place.
Well, I think you could have.
I mean, why not? I mean, why not double your chances? We'll pick it up there. The accident man, Tom Kane. Your questions and your comments and his true identity, such as it is, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. And Tom Kane, and let's go ahead and have the real Tom Kane sign in, please?
Hi. Well, in that case, I shall sign in. My name is David Thomas.
And Americans might know your work best by what works you've written.
I have had fun. If there's any Americans involved in the men's movement, years ago I wrote a book called Not Guilty, The Case in Defense of Men, which was really an investigation into the image of men that had been portrayed by the pretty more extreme end of the feminist movement, the kind of all men are rapists, all men are this, that, and the other. And it was really just me thinking to myself in a kind of painfully liberal way at the time, well, I'm sure I'm not one of those people, and my dad isn't one of those people, and my friends, as far as I know, don't go around raping and abusing women, and nor do they want to. And really just trying to see what the truth, and literally in scientific terms, if there was any data about kind of the actual identity and nature of men, because this is a period where there was a lot of what we used to call gender studies, which basically meant women's studies.
Right.
And that was, I guess, the thing.
You've done a lot of interesting work with rock and roll bands, though.
Yeah, right? I have. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I think that's pretty
cool.
Fun
side of it.
You've interviewed a lot of people that that most of us could only dream about talking to.
I mean, well, you know, Stone several times, Bowie several times, Queen, The Floyd. My proudest boast, actually, my proudest rock and roll boast is that I have sung "Wish You Were Here" by Pink Floyd with David Gilmour accompanying me on guitar. That's my.
Oh, how cool is that?
That's my big I could have died and gone to heaven moment.
You know,
the whole song. We were sitting around a campfire at the time. It was kind of a camping weekend, and tents up everywhere, and the barbecue going. And he got out his guitar and started playing the chords, and I sang it. And it was definitely a moment. Like, frankly, if life could have ended then, it would have been perfectly satisfactory. I've hung out with lots of bands on the road, and that was kind of how I spent. If you've ever seen that great film, Almost Famous,
right?
That. Cameron Crowe's film, which kind of tells the story of him in his early years as a journalist. I sort of watched that and I thought, oh my God, that was me kind of 10 years after him. You know, that sense of being young and naive and out on the road has just really brought it home to me.
You know, I had a similar experience with Gary Tallent, who is the bass player for the E Street Band. And it just happened to be a fluke Christmas party on stage with him. And he said, he just turned to me, he said, let's do Jailhouse Rock. and I said, okay. And then he started to play it. And I immediately forgot all of the lyrics because it's the boss's bass player. And
yeah,
I was like, I could have done that song in my sleep. But
sorry, go ahead.
Well, I want to get back to we've got a full boat of questions. Lots of people want to talk with Tom Kane.
Oh, I'm going to tell you about singing Beatles songs with Annie Lennox and Dave Stewart then. Fair enough.
You could, but you'd leave a bunch of people stranded, and they want to talk about The Accident Man. So I'll go back to calling you Tom Kane. Creating accidents for money. It is a real industry, and whether or not people get millions for it, we can't confirm, except that it does happen, and there are interesting cover-ups. And one case we haven't talked about yet in America, I'd love to get your feedback on, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Getting back to the phone calls, some people have been hanging on a half hour here, so I thank Karen in Minneapolis for her warm patience this evening. And I'm sure it's as cold where you are across town from where I am, about negative 40 right now.
Right.
Karen, your question for Tom Kane?
Well, my question is, why is it that nobody ever considers that the real target of a killer in the Diana story was Dodie?
You know, that's a very, very good question.
And how much would you pay for someone who could have put that together for someone who wanted to see that he didn't inherit from his dad, or they didn't like that he was running around with a woman and interfered with their religious whatever? I mean, there are all kinds of angles that I can see where someone would want to do away with him.
Karen, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think that he has, if you like, suffered by being because he's not a star. It's as simple as that. The star always gets the attention. Diana was, if nothing else, an absolutely monumental star. And certainly, Muhammad Fayyad, for years and years and years, long before any of this, was guarded himself obsessively. I mean, he had armed guards and extreme security measures going back into the 80s in England, at a time when people in England regarded this as completely bizarre. And so he always operated under extreme conditions of personal security. And I don't know who he felt his enemies were, but he certainly felt he had them. And yes, one can certainly imagine that somebody who wanted, and if you think about it, well, here is this man and here is his son. If you can't get to the guy, you take out the son because it's going to cause. I mean, look at the effect it has had on Muhammad Fayyad. I mean, he's been devastated by this. He has, he's been driven. You know, he's kind of still 10 years on, in a state of something approaching hysteria about it, and it's clearly had a totally destructive effect on him. So yes, I completely agree with you. It seems to me just as credible that Dodie was the target, and that Diana, if you like, from the point of view of the assassin, is both a kind of a smokescreen and I use this phrase, and I appreciate this kind of taste, but an added bonus, if you like. It's like, you get one free.
Collateral damage.
Collateral, yeah, but kind of quite, from the point of view of an assassin, very useful collateral damage, since she
doubly hurts your prime target, i.e. Mohammed Fayyad, causes him extraordinary pain, embarrassment, shame, what have you, and distracts everybody's attention from what you're trying to do, which is to get to Dodi. So I completely agree with you. And indeed, in my book, Carver, the assassin, thinks he's taking out the man in the car. He doesn't have a correct identification of the man, but he believes his target is the man in the car, not the woman.
West of the Rockies, Ben is in Denver on Coast to Coast AM for Tom Kane. Ben?
Good morning. I just, you know, how does Princess Di compare to Britney Spears? Come on, you know. Princess
No, I don't know
Di,
what you mean by that. What do you mean?
You know, she had her whole thing, and Britney is a pop queen. How does that even compare?
We don't know what you mean. What is it? What's your point?
Because Princess Di was a princess of a country, and Britney Spears is a pop queen.
I don't think anybody's talked about Britney Spears.
Okay. Well,
that's what I'm just saying. We haven't talked about it in that context. Let me get to wild card line, Don.
I think poor Brittany needs any help destroying.
Good evening.
Himself.
Yeah, Don for yes. Tom Kane. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, my comment is after World War II, Stalin wanted to get rid of an up-and-coming communist leader, politician, and his very words, he usually would talk over the phone quietly, but he told the functionaries, make it look like an accident, which they did. Now, my question is, our country has spent so much money in Iraq, and it isn't worth one of our Marines' lives to have been over there doing the war. Why couldn't we have made it look like an accident? And I'm asking your guests that. And
you mean about Saddam Hussein?
Saddam.
You mean Saddam?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
I think the answer is that sadly, the capacity of American, indeed British intelligence, to get people on the ground in the Middle East had been drastically reduced. I mean, if you're looking at America in particular, there was a tremendous, for a number of reasons, to do with partly the failings of the old regimes and various cases like that, where you had drastic intelligence failings, to do also with a general political distaste, sort of post-Watergate distaste for intelligence activities, to do with an increasingly risk-averse culture. The trend in American intelligence was away from human intelligence and human activity and towards all manner of technological activity. And so I think there was quite simply a lack of people who had any expertise in the Middle East. But clearly the CIA, if you go back and look at, say, made several attempts to get rid of Castro, it was spectacularly unsuccessfully. Now, there is a guy who's living 90 miles off the coast of Florida, and they couldn't get rid of him. Saddam Hussein lived a bit like Mohammed Fayyad in a bubble of incredibly intense personal security around him, which would have been very, very difficult to penetrate unless you had first penetrated the security itself. In other words, you would have to have inside people. And my point is that I don't believe the CIA or American intelligence in general was in any position, or has been until very recently, and maybe even not now, to get anybody into the close circles of Saddam Hussein, and B, if they did, then to carry out any kind of operation. I just don't think the capacity at an operational level has existed for some while. I mean, frankly, American intelligence, and again, possibly British intelligence as well, has been a disaster. I mean, the multiple failings of the intelligence community in the years leading up to 9/11 are very well documented. You know, when you see movies like The Bourne Identity or Enemy of the State, you get this impression of this all-powerful, organization which can spot somebody anywhere and take somebody out anywhere and has assets everywhere. From what I understand from people in the CIA, they quite like that because it makes them look a great deal smarter than they really are. What you got to remember about government organizations is they're government organizations. The same people who run the post office run the CIA. You know what I'm saying? The same people who run, you know, your rubbish collection. The truth of the matter is that government organizations, by and large, are startlingly incompetent, and they have had a very, very poor, Osama bin Laden.
You know, there are endless stories. Was he ever in the, you know, did people ever have him in their sights? But right. The order never came through from Washington. That's, you know, it's one of those stories one hears again and again in various contexts. The fact remains, they have had since, well, he was first a target, certainly back in the mid-90s, and an attempted target back in the mid-90s, and various attempts have been made in his life, and the compound where he lived was bombed after the attacks on Kenya, though he'd moved out. But they haven't got him. I mean, the fact of the matter is, for the last 15 years, they've known about him, and they have not got him. They knew about Saddam Hussein for many, many years, and they didn't get him. I think you've just got to bear in mind that these people aren't as smart as I guess, writers like me make them sometimes seem.
Well, I want to get to as many people as we can, so I'll ask everybody on the phones to keep their questions short.
I'll keep short. I'm sorry, I tend to go on my answer.
It's okay. But I do want to point out, too, that there was the I wonder whether you'd ever given any thought to the case of U.S. Commerce Secretary Ron Brown and his plane going down with 34 others, and how – and it's always – I mean, I'm sure – in the end, the Air Force investigators are right. It was an accident. But there was always the suspicion that there were gunshot wounds to
right.
some of the people on the plane. And I kept thinking
there's another case where I was going to come to, actually, which I think is really interesting, related directly to Diana in our country, a guy called Barry Manicky, who was a Royal Protection Officer, a policeman who was on bodyguard duty with Diana. And they had an affair, which is now publicly admitted that Diana and Manicky were lovers. And Manicky was killed in a motorbike accident, conveniently. He was riding pillion on a bike and came off the back of a bike, and the whole case kind of disappeared immediately after. It was an accident. Oof. Diana was herself absolutely convinced that he had been murdered, and that was what made her think that she would also be murdered. So I can't speak to that. The plane accident you were talking about. The other, again, something which, in the back of my mind, as one of those cases where there was, and I say this as a Brit, not knowing the full facts, but I'm sure your audience will know, is Vince Foster. I seem to recall that back in the day there were tremendous doubts about Vince Foster's. Was it a suicide?
Yeah. That is a case that also on the surface appears to be fully vetted, and in the end comes back to a history of mental instability, some other factors that went into it, but questions will always linger. Let's get to Elizabeth on the international line. She's in Toronto on Coast to Coast AM for Tom Kane. Elizabeth?
Good evening, Tom and Ian. Tom, I'd like your comment on this theory. I seems to me it points to a deliberate accident, but seems she was so conveniently dead for Prince Charles, who wanted to marry Camilla, and he wanted to be king, and he could not be head of state as long as a divorced man. And suddenly this man who seems to be indulged in every which way has exactly what he wants with her death.
I don't think that Charles has the strength of character or ruthlessness to order her death. I don't think also, I correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe there's anything which prevents him from being head of state if he's divorced. I mean, he'd already divorced Diana, and that was in no way a threat to his inheritance of the throne. I don't think there's any, I mean, goodness knows, King Henry VIII proved that. I mean, he divorced twice and beheaded another couple and what have you. So I don't think that he was not affected. He was only affected insofar as long as Diana was alive, public opinion would have made it very, very difficult for him to marry Diana. But that said...
To marry Camilla.
Camilla, I'm so sorry. Right. Camilla, absolutely. That said, if Diana had herself married Dodi and had his baby, that would have made life a great deal easier for Charles. The public could hardly have prevented Charles from remarrying if Diana had already done so. So frankly, for Charles's point of view, if she marries Dodi and then has a baby, and if the baby is controversial, and if this maybe makes Diana a bit less popular, that's all great news for Charles. Whereas if Diana is martyred, and is for certainly a couple of years after her death, you know, held up, you know, goodbye England's right. Rose and all that sort of stuff, frankly, Charles suffered a great deal in the immediate wake of her death, quite apart from the fact that, you know, his sons lost their mother. I don't think that Charles, whatever you may say about Charles, and he certainly has his faults, I don't think he's a man who would kill his own son's mother.
Let's leave that there. Kathy is in Westfield, Massachusetts, first-time caller line for Tom Kane.
Hi.
The accident man. Go ahead, Kathy.
You know, good morning to both of you.
Hi, Kathy.
You know, I really don't know who could have ordered the hit, but I'll bet you it goes back to the monarchy somewhere in that family. She was an embarrassment to the crown. She was, if she left the family completely from England, the two kids would have went with her. There's something here that just doesn't make sense. I really believe the theory that...
I don't think the kids would have gone, by the way. I can tell you, they would have stayed in their education. Because after she'd already left...
She'd already kind of left them off already, hadn't she? I mean, in a way, she had. They were visiting her, but they weren't living with her. So,
yeah.
All right, Chris is in Houston, Texas, on Coast to Coast AM for Tom Kane. Chris,
morning, guys.
Hi, Nate.
Question for you: how you feel about the last December? I can't think of her name, but she was killed in a car wreck after supposedly gunfire out in the Middle East. I can't think of her name though.
Gunfire in the Middle East. The journalist.
You mean Bhutto?
Oh, okay,
yeah.
In Pakistan. Okay,
yeah,
sure.
Pakistan.
Benazir Bhutto.
Right. She was killed the same way almost, and supposedly at first she was shot, then she hit her head. She fell out the sunroof or something and hit her head on the window.
I think in the case of Bhutto, it's a straightforward assassination. I believe Al-Qaeda believed to, or certainly reactionary Islamist forces within Pakistan are linked to that. I mean, you know, in the Indian subcontinent in general, there is, after all, a long tradition of political assassination.
Including her father.
Indeed. And various Gandhis also. So I think that's an interesting case because that, see, one of the things that came back up on accidents is sometimes you want an assassination to be very private. Other times you want it to be very public. You want to let the whole world know you got to this person and you took them out. And you want the whole world to see it happen. And in the case of Bhutto, it happened right out there in public. So I think that's a more interesting, that's an example of if you like, there's the Donald Rumsfeld thing about the things we know we don't know, and the things we don't even know we don't know. And accidental assassinations are like the things we don't know, if you see what I mean, because we don't even know the assassinations.
Right, and we may never suspect it.
They
may have been so good at it, we would peel back the veil of history, we would go, get out.
Exactly. Now, with Bhutto, it's we know it, because we know, because it happens. Kind of not quite on prime time. On prime time, it was happening live in front of a million people. That was a straightforward hit, and that was the extreme reactionary religious forces in Pakistan saying we will not allow a conventional westernized politician to govern Pakistan in the Western model. I think that's what that's about.
I look forward to hearing more of your real life research into the fictional accident man, Tom Kane. The sequel's coming out this summer. Read the new book now and then be ready. And thank you so much for such a lively conversation.
Ian, thank you. And thank you to everybody who called in. I'm sorry, some people got a cut off there, and I apologize to them. But it's been a great fun. And you gave me a couple of titles and two or three plot ideas. And I think a character name, too. What was he called again? Something Bone Shaker or?
Chad Bone Steel. If you want to go with
Steel.
Yeah,
he's
going to
be in the next book. That's going to be our little private gag there.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And also coming up tomorrow night, then, on Coast to Coast AM, How to Build a Robot Army. Dr. Daniel Wilson will join us with an equally entertaining book. You can link up with Tom at coasttocoastam.com until tomorrow night. Deus te amat, and I do too.